Thank you for listening to the Following Films podcast. Today I'm joined by Don Mickelson, Carrie Pickett, and Jennifer Weir, the co-directors and subject of the new documentary film, Finding Her Beat. In the midst of a frozen Minnesota winter, a Japanese drum master and a Korean adoptee from North Dakota join forces to assemble the world's greatest taiko drummers in a bold effort to claim a cultural spotlight that has historically been reserved only for men. Through grueling rehearsals, Jennifer weaves together their disparate voices and styles as vulnerability, pain, and joys are shared. And we quickly see bonds of friendship form as these talented women navigate through differences in culture, age, language, and performance styles. As the clock ticks towards their first performance, it becomes clear their story has become something much larger than taiko. But before our conversation with the team behind Finding Her Beat, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Bookmans, an independent bookstore that believes in the magic of storytelling and the cinematic arts. To expand your collection of films, music, or books, visit your nearest Bookmans and discover something truly wonderful. And if you haven't already, please follow the Following Films podcast on Spotify to show your support. This will help us to continue to bring you in-depth conversations with the talented individuals who shape the world of cinema. Finding Her Beat is currently available on Amazon Prime. I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks.
Chris, you are on with Dawn and Carrie, our directors, and Jen, who basically is the star and heart.
Of course. How could I not know Jennifer after spending an hour and a half with her last night? So
there we go.
Exactly. So I'm just going to shut up and let you guys have a great interview.
Thanks, awesome. Annie.
Thank you. Well, thank you all so much for taking the time to do this today. I really do appreciate it. I really did love this film. I'm somebody who, any performance piece, I'm just a sucker for music anyway, live music especially. And when you add in taiko, the elements of, it's almost like dance on some elements. Mm-hmm. And I'm just floored by it. And it's such a profoundly beautiful art form that is underseen in this country. And I just want to talk about kind of all of your exposure to this, if you could, just as an art form, how you first became introduced to this. I guess, Jennifer, we could start with you. I know we go into that a little bit in the film, but.
Yeah, well, I'm a Korean adoptee, and I was raised in North Dakota by a white family, and I had no references for being Asian, Asian American, Asian arts, nothing. And the first time I saw taiko drumming, it was just one guy, Rick Shiomi, in a drum and maybe 45 seconds of a demonstration. I just thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And so the thing I always say is that I don't really have any claim to taiko drumming, but it claimed me. And from that moment, it's been in my life now decades later, and I'm running a taiko organization. I just fell in love with it because of the things you talked about, like the grace and the choreography and the movement, and just it's such a unique, visceral, empowering, beautiful art form. And I just love it so much.
It's such a unique form of music where when the visual element of it is so important. I mean, you can listen to it on its own and it still stands on its own, but the visual component adds so much to it. It's such an incredible layer of this. So yeah. Absolutely. And Dawn, just kind of going through here, how did you first become aware of taiko music?
Through Jen.
How did you become aware of Jen? I
guess. Friends since our early 20s. And, I was a theater music kid. And I think that there's a connection to, the music in particular, and to your point, the theatricality of it. But particularly that rhythm, the big booming bassing, we were talking about that, if the world was my oyster and, we could make any film you want about taiko, to somehow show the dust falling from the ceiling of venues when they get taiko in there for the first time, because like the room hasn't shaken like that in 100 and some years. Like stuff like that. It's just, it shakes your innards in a way that is very pleasing. And I've been watching Jen dedicate her life to this art form for 20 years. In admiration for a number of reasons.
Completely makes sense. Absolutely. And Carrie, how did you become aware of this art form, or Jen, I guess?
Well, I, my first career was as a photographer. And I've somebody who has always thought that the drummer shouldn't sit in the back. I've photographed a lot of music in my 20s and a lot of music through the years. And I've always thought that why do they put the drummers in the back? Like, they're doing all the cool stuff and keeping it, like, why are they in the back? And so I had an assignment one time to photograph Rick Shiomi's Theater Moo, and I saw Tycho there and was immediately enthralled. And if I was a different person, I might have acted like Jen, because it's so captivating and, you know, alarming in its fabulousness.
Absolutely. It's one of those things where I'm a theater kid. I was a big theater nerd. I was a technical person, though. I tried acting. The world's better off without me acting in it. And so I learned how to, you know, turn a wrench, and I was a tech kid. But I just loved being around theater, being around performance. I had to be around creatives. It was just something that I'm drawn to. And I think it's very similar in that. And one of the things that I picked up also, Carrie, was just seeing a lot of live performance. The drummer, the way we set it up, they have the best view of the house. When you stand on that, when you sit with that riser and that view from where they sit in traditional rock music, it's such a great view of an audience. Yes. That you don't really get from any other position. It's really a great place to sit. So, Jen, can you talk a little bit about how you were approached to make a film about this, I guess, this 18 months that you had rolling up to this idea that you had for a lifetime, and how nerve-wracking it must have been to put on this event that was literally a globe-spanning event, and to have it filmed at the same time? Because we all take on tasks that we could fall flat on our faces during, but very few of us are willing to do that in such a vulnerable way.
Lots of opportunities there. I would say, well, the whole thing came through a lunch with Dawn. I was telling her about this dream project of this concert, and, oh, hey, Dawn, maybe you could, you know, videotape it so we have the concert footage, you know, forever. And the more we talked about it, and we were talking too about, like, you know, being queer moms and artists and you know, male dominated fields and all the things that we're trying to do. And then the more we talked, Dawn just looked at me and said, you know, this is more than a concert. This is a film. In fact, maybe it's a movement. And that was the launch that launched this whole idea of turning it into a film as well. So then from the beginning, we just embedded Dawn and Carrie everywhere and every step of it. And of course, Dawn is like, I know just how I want to do this. Let's do this in the most difficult way possible.
So Dawn, I think the finger's been pointed at this point. Do you have a response to that?
She's right. It was the most difficult way possible. No, I'd come off of a previous film called Minnesota Mean, that we'd shot just previous to this. And I realized that I'd fallen in love with the verite footage much more than my interviews. And so, you know, the idea of being able to follow this story in almost, you know, an entirely verite way, no interviews, and just be able to capture things as they're happening and tell it in a really, you know, cinematic, almost fiction film kind of way, was, you know, one of those creative challenges that really excited me. And then also we talked a lot about the idea of having the film reflect the Herbeat movement and who is on the stage. And so that the crew is almost entirely female, non-binary, queer, or Asian, or a combination of those descriptors. Because, you know, back to that story, Jen and I were, you know, having that conversation over lunch, and this idea that our industries are very similar in many ways. And there are a bunch of amazing women, non-binary folks who are creating, who have been doing careers for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, and are still not given that, you know, golden ring, or I don't know what people get, because I've never gotten one. But, you know, the opportunity to do something big and something, you know, flashy and maybe expensive. And so the idea of being able to bring women and non-binary and Asian and queer folks to the production as well, I think just amplified the mission. It amplified everybody's work on this project because they saw themselves on that stage. They felt the story was very personal for one or more reasons. Sure. So yeah, and yeah, it's so this film has a lot of kind of embedded missions, whether it be creative or, you know, storytelling or, you know, let's change the world kind of missions.
Well, there's something that's really interesting that happens in films like this. When you make something that is hyper, hyper specific about a specific art with a very specific voice or group of voices that are underheard and underserviced. And when you make that, you end up making a universal story, because this is something that's straight white dude from the suburbs. It's not really my story, but I am absolutely told. I feel seen in this film. Anybody that has been the outsider on something that feels like they're wanting to be accepted, and God, who doesn't relate to that feeling? You absolutely have, this is a story that you can relate to, but that's because you weren't trying to tell something universal. You were telling your story. You were telling Jen's story and these women's stories, this group of non-binary individual stories. The 47-year-old in me, I don't want to screw up something. I'm horrible at these things, but I absolutely loved that about this, that it is something that is not mine, but I felt connected to it. And the other thing you did here, Dawn, that's really impressive, you and Carrie both, the film, you talk about how this is leaning into the Verité style. A lot of times when you have stylistic choices like that, they call attention to themselves. You do something that is invisible in that, where you don't feel that. You don't feel the missing talking heads in here. You don't feel like you need to cut to exposition dumps of, you know, the screen having title cards every 3 minutes to explain what's going on. You did a really wonderful job of constructing this in that format.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we kind of want to do it again. You need another Tycho film.
And so then as co-directors here, how do you divide and conquer? Do you say you're handling this side of it? You're handling this how do you divide that up? Those duties?
I think that that really all kind of fell together very naturally and without any kind of preconceived plan about how it was going to run. We just fell into our path by our skill sets. And we both participated in the edit, and along with two other editors as well. And so I think, you know, we both had our hand in everything along the way. And I don't know, it was just so easy and seamless. And even though I think when you start a documentary film, you don't know where it's going. But in this case, we knew where it was heading. We didn't know if it was going to get there, but we knew that there was going to be the residency and the concert. We knew that there would be obstacles. We didn't realize what obstacles would come along, you know? And so I think that was there was a lot of unknown elements. We had 18 women who all deserved to be featured in a mini series of, you know, one per episode could have been, you know,
sure.
Because each one was a superstar in their own right. They had just never really been given that license to take it to this other level where they got to play and experiment and learn from one another in this situation. And that was Jen's beautiful vision. And so it's so exciting to, as a filmmaker, to be able to have the focus be an art and an art form and artists, where, you know, it's not so scary. You think you kind of know where you're going. And, you know, who could see the pandemic coming? Nobody. You know, who could see some of the many challenges of putting all these people in one place and they don't all speak the same language? You know, it's really, there were a lot of variables that were really tricky. And it all just, even with the obstacles, everybody just came together so well. And I really think that was because of Jen's leadership and Tiffany and Megan's commitment And excitement to have their vision and dream being manifested in this beautiful way.
It really is beautiful. And one of the things I was struck by, there's for this number of performers to be getting together on stage, people are world-class musicians all together. There didn't seem to be a lot of ego, which is something that's pretty remarkable to get. You know, you get me and two of my untalented friends in the same room together, and we're going to ego clash within about 30 seconds. It felt like, and I don't know if that's just a horrible male curse that I'm a part of and a victim to that I have to keep in check at all times, but I'm aware of it and I do try to work on it. Could you talk a little bit about that element of just getting, where the hell was the diva in this group? I didn't feel that. Oh,
well, that's interesting. Because I experienced it.
It didn't seem that way from the outside.
Yeah, but it is a very unique situation. One is that everyone had the utmost respect for each other. So any of those things came from the desire to want to make something the best it could be. And so it wasn't sort of people trying to one-up each other. It was just that, oh, I have a different process to get the best work out of what I do. And I have a very different process of how I work, you know, et cetera. And then you add the cultural layer of, oh, many of us are Asian American or Asian. And therefore, there is a certain way that saving face and not saying how you feel, but just having it inferred was probably why it doesn't kind of come forward. But yeah, it's fascinating. There's so much that's in the unsaid. So that's why I was so fascinated by like, Don and Carrie, what are you going to do? Like, how is this going to come together? Because my lived experience of it is different than what's on the film, because they show more than what I experienced. It's like a bigger view. And so when I watched it, I was like, oh, like I remember this. I don't remember that. I wasn't there for that. And oh, I see how it all like looks like we're heading towards somewhere as opposed to like falling apart at any given moment, you know? So yeah, it was a real gift what they brought, that way of weaving all of the things that were happening into sort of a coherent arc was stunning. And I have to say this group, if the conflict would have been like three layers under, in terms of recognizing it. And that's why some of the time I was really clueless, which was super, super helpful actually, to not really know until later what someone was thinking or feeling. So I was like, yes, thank you. but like anything, I think anytime you go big, everyone's fully invested. And when you're fully invested, you're going to have struggle and conflict. And just the way that plays out with women and with women who respect each other, and then with women who are in an Asian or Asian American context, is very different, you know? So, yeah. So it's both and where I'm like, yeah, it was there, but no, it didn't manifest in the usual ways, I would say.
But yeah, that's fascinating. I was wondering if that was the case, because I didn't, my parents, one of them is from the South, one of them is from England. So these are both repressed people who do not express themselves very well, very openly. It's not their first thought is to say how they feel in a situation necessarily. And I think that the generations that have come past that, I'm far too in touch with my feelings, I think now, maybe for my parents' liking. But hopefully we were raising a next generation of children that are by far better than we are, so that we can, you know, they can head off a lot of this nonsense that we come across. So please go
ahead.
You
know what's super cool too, is because Carrie and Don created such a, have such integrity and created such trust within, you know, the group of everybody, is like, they were our extended family essentially. What you actually saw was a private side of many of these artists who are trained their whole life not to show that. So even just the risk of being on camera, period, like letting them show anything of their private life was a huge risk and step for people. So it was kind of amazing that they got to that level of comfort and intimacy and trust that they did.
Well, you touch on that in the film, the idea that you're sick, you're injured, you're hurt, you have to go on and you have to be stoic and you have to express that in that. But because they're telling me that, I don't feel that guarded nature when they are talking. They're very open mm-hmm. about it. So you don't feel that. You see it in their performances, but you don't see that when they're actually interacting with one another, even though there's, like you said, two layers beneath that. There's something going on that I'm not necessarily privy to. And that's really interesting. I think that will necessitate a rewatch at this point.
There you go.
For some of the
For sure. Then when you're not feeling well, you know, it's doubly hard to then have somebody with a camera. And actually, because there were two of us, oftentimes there were two. We sometimes didn't both film at the same time or in the same room, but primarily the goal was with that cinema verite approach to be able to cut between the two cameras. And so then as filmmakers, like, you know, masking people when they're not feeling well to let me in. And so it was challenging.
About how many hours of footage did you have when you were editing this down?
You know, Dawn says 200, but that seems low to me.
This episode of the Following Films podcast is brought to you by Bookmans. So today I went into Bookmans and decided to try to find a film by Michael Mann. I went over to the Blu-ray section and saw copies of several films I already own, and then I found it, Black Hat. This is one I haven't seen in quite a while since it came out, and I figured maybe it was time for a reassessment of this much maligned film. So Black Hat is a cybercrime thriller directed by Michael Mann that delves into the world of cybercrime, hacking, and international intrigue. While it promises to be a gripping exploration of the dangers lurking in the digital age, the execution falls short of expectations. The film follows convicted hacker played by Chris Hemsworth, who's temporarily released from prison to help the American and Chinese authorities track down a criminal network that's responsible for a series of major attacks. As the hunt takes them across the globe, Hemsworth's character must navigate the murky waters of the criminal underworld while grappling with his own demons. One of the film's major shortcomings is its lack of technical accuracy and realism. While it attempts to portray the world of hacking authentically, it often falls into cliches and inaccuracies that ultimately undermine the credibility of the story. So the hacking sequences are exaggerated and unrealistic, relying more on flashy visuals than genuine technical expertise. And this is coming from an absolute layman. I am not somebody who knows anything about hacking, and yet I can see some of the things that just flat out aren't true in this film. And that particular disconnect may disappoint viewers familiar with the subject matter or looking for a more grounded portrayal of cybercrime. So despite these flaws, though, Black Hat does have its moments. Michael Mann's signature style is evident in the film's beautiful, sleek cinematography and the signature action sequences, and the international setting adds depth to the narrative. It highlights the global nature of cyber threats and the challenges of international cooperation. Chris Hemsworth delivers a solid performance as Hathaway, bringing the character a sense of depth who's grappling for redemption. And the supporting cast includes, I had no idea, I'd completely forgotten this, but Viola Davis, who's really great in the film and adds a lot to the film. But ultimately, Black Hat falls short of its potential. While it offers a glimpse into the world of cybercrime and espionage, its lack of technical accuracy and reliance on cliches detracts from the overall experience. And despite its flaws, fans of Michael Mann's work or of the cyber thriller genre, I guess if you're a huge Johnny Mnemonic fan and you're looking for some more cyber thriller, you could do worse than Black Hat. However, for those seeking a more realistic, nuanced exploration of hacking and cybersecurity, this might leave you wanting more, and I'm not sure I can recommend this one. But despite that, this gave me the chance to check out a film that I've been meaning to reevaluate, because I keep hearing that Black Hat is an underrated film, and maybe I'll give it another 10 years, follow back up with this one, and see if it does end up coming around for me. But remember, Bookmans, they have your cool covered. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks. always such an absurd amount of film to go through to find a story. And you probably could have told 10 different movies within this. So how do you find your narrative within that? Are you going along and just saying, okay, today I found this one thing, put that to the side? Or is it just going back and looking at it all together? How do you find it? Editing this stuff is alchemy to me. I don't understand it.
We did it in succession. And so I did the first edit. And so I took and matched all the cameras and then made 8 hours of scenes with the best camera coming up, lifting up the best camera, and then passed it on. And it got passed on. And then Dawn had it at the very end. And she just like took everybody's hours and hours and months and months and months and months of work and made it look effortless.
Well,
with
you.
Her final edit was really, it's amazing with an edit, the way you can be really close and it just doesn't sing. And then you hit it and it sings.
Well, good editing is invisible. So what was just said looked effortless, I'm sure was not effortless. So how was that process for you, Dawn?
Well, I really benefited from, one of my favorite parts of the edit really is that trying to figure out how the story plays out. Like once you've got a set of scenes, being able to move them around and have them play off of each other, the structure of the story is not the structure of the story when I got it. It wasn't the structure of the story 6 months into when I had it. We were playing with structure for a long time. And I love that. Like I get really geeky about, like, I love how when you move one line somewhere else and all of a sudden it works, you're like, oh my God. It feels very like magic. It feels woo-woo and spiritual and all the things. And so, that really is my favorite part. But it was a lot of footage. And I think when you were asking the question, you were I don't know if you meant this, but you were asking about essentially were we doing dailies with somebody like, hey, these are great from this day.
Yeah, kind of pulling.
We didn't
out
have the,
moments. The
crew for that.
No,
okay. It's like it
or
was
the time.
No, the crew or the time. It was like just back up that footage and hope to God that we backed it up twice. because you have to have it twice, there. Otherwise, you're in trouble. But so really, it all was Carrie in that first pass digging in and looking at it from day one.
And also having to intuit which scenes were relevant in a language that wasn't hers.
Yes.
How do you do that? That's a really good point, Jennifer. Yeah, because you take it for granted there's a good piece of this that is not in your native tongue. So how are you doing that?
Well, when Dawn was talking about the crew reflecting the people behind the scenes, reflecting the people in front of the scenes, the women that were filming, the people who were filming with me were just amazing. And we had Shiho Fukada in Japan and Carolyn Mariko Stuckey in America. And they both spoke Japanese. And I think that when we set it up and we went into it, there was this feeling like, oh, Carrie, they will help you with the language. But then what really in actuality happened is that I really, because I don't know where that setup is going to come from that is going to give me the payoff later. I really, anything that interests me, I'm in there and I'm filming as much as I can. And I would really rather throw away footage than wish I had something and not have it in the can. And so there was actually no time while we're filming for anybody to tell me what was being said or what was going on, because otherwise we would interrupt the scene.
Yeah, you couldn't stop for translation in those moments, those exchanges.
Way.
So no, of course not.
No,
so in my Taiko group, Hiroshi Yoshino was the hero in that. Carrie would have these scenes. She's like, I think they're talking about something interesting here. And then so we took those scenes and then he translated into Japanese. And then we also had to translate it back into English. And then we had to, he had put in so many hours as a translator too. And not just word for word, but like really the intention behind things. So he's like one of the unsung heroes of this film for sure.
Because there's so much nuance in a casual conversation, the way that you speak, that you have to, yeah, it's not a word for word translation. You have to get the emotion behind it. Because, you know, yes, of course, that's, I don't know how people do it. I don't. It's like editing 200, 300, 400 hours of footage. I can't get my head around that kind of a job. I've, yeah, tried to edit, you know, an hour into 3 minutes and I walk away. It's too much. I find it very difficult to divorce myself from what's in my mind. And so to put yourself constantly in the perspective of somebody who's never seen the material before is so challenging to me. I don't understand how people do it, but I'm just, that's why I'm not a filmmaker. I'm on the side of the camera right now, just talking to people who do it.
And I also think that there's a benefit of having multiple editors for that very reason, because you know, as an editor, when you've hit the point where you have no perspective anymore, and that's, you know, that's the point where, I mean, not so much with this film, but with other films where I'm like, okay, and now I'm bringing in somebody else because I cannot see it anymore. I don't know what I'm looking at. And with this film, we just, it was a natural progression of one person leading to the next. But yeah, it is important to bring in other people, whether it's in the edit or obviously we also went through rounds and rounds and rounds of feedback with people who knew Tycho, people who had never seen Tycho, you know, everything in between, because we wanted to see how does this hit the audience who we know is going to show up because they just love Tycho and like nobody makes things about Tycho, so they're going to be there no matter what the film is like. And you've got folks who have no idea what Tycho is, and how do we make sure that they understand it without turning it into a PBS, and this is how it works, you know, documentary. And here is the long history starting, and, you know, like,
I don't know. I'm kind of, I know that's not what you made, but I am a sucker for some of those long form PBS. Ken Burns is my, I'm okay with it. So
he's a good egg, but you know, that's not the film we were making.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, but there's such a, into what you're talking about with that, it's a leap of faith that people will beyond these very specific groups, because you assume that other people will have interest in this story, and you have to tell it in a way that is accessible, but you also don't want to pander and you don't want to talk down to people that already know the story and understand it. So that's a tough balance where you have to explain and sort of level set the world to some degree. But I think you do that in less than 3 minutes before the time the opening credit hits, and probably 90% of that is music that you're doing, and it tells the story. And I think that's the most efficient and most powerful way to tell it. So,
yay! Neely Hay is the composer, and she did a great job. And she's from Australia.
Can we talk a little bit about the sound and music in this? Because my God, this is, I have not, I would much rather see this in a theater, but watching this at home on a screener, I was fortunate enough to watch it early enough and to have a film that I could watch with the volume turned up while my kids were still awake, which is nice. And not many of the films that I'm doing, I can do that. So normally this is a like 11 o'clock thing. So I had the volume turned up really loud, and man, the sound in this thing is incredible, and it's such an important part of it. And I, you know, the Sonos bass speaker that I have, the subwoofer for it, it got a workout last night, nice. So it was great.
It's funny, when we were doing the sound mix, we were incredibly fortunate that, you know, I've been working with Carly Zuckweiler, our re-recording mixer, for decades. And this film, though, because of the importance of the drum and the sound and really wanting particularly the bassy parts to shine, we were so incredibly fortunate to be asked to come to Skywalker Sound to do the sound. And so Carly worked with Laura Hirschberg on, you know, my main direction when we entered that was, I was like, I want people's butts to vibrate. Can we make butts vibrate? And she's like, yeah, let's make some butts vibrate, you know? So, but cause again, it's back to that lived experience of Tycho. What does that feel like? Your whole body vibrates. Yeah. How do we do that short of putting a bass can under people's seats? You know, like, so we worked really hard on that piece. And then as Carrie mentioned, also there's that piece of the music by Neely Hay. And I think that you know, her mission was to fill in those more nuanced, subtle emotional moments that, that, you know, don't exist in the music we recorded of Tycho, but not compete with that Tycho music either. And she came in with a very clear vision of how it was going to sound and how it was going to bring up and, you know, showcase the drums. Rather than try to show it up in some way, or, you know, like she wasn't precious about like, this is my music and my muse. It was like, no, how do we serve the scene? How do we serve these drums? And so actually, you know, probably one of my favorite moments of the film is in the final performance of 11, where all the performers are on the stage, and it's this amazing piece that Kaoli Asano, wrote, but it's also being, there's this subtle soundtrack behind it that lifts it even higher, that Mili created, that when she first sent us a draft of, you know, that it's one of those crying moments when you're watching something and you're like, that works. You know, that's so good. You know, that's my tell of like, if something is on the right track, is if I'm crying. And yeah, crying was great.
I'm an easy cry too.
Nice.
So yeah, I'm not ashamed of that. And so, and it is something that it is mostly invisible because it's emotionally resonant and it's something that is not drawing attention to itself. And it is, as you said, it's supporting the existing. And so you don't even know that it's there at first. Yep. And that was something that when I was first watching the film, I didn't even pick this up, that first 3-minute sequence, that there was these these little pieces in between. Because I was watching it and then I went out to the living room. It's like, my wife, I need to watch this with you. This is something we need to watch together. I just wanted her to see this. By the time you get to the shoulders and you just see it's just so incredible. And I was like, this is a powerful individual just destroying this instrument right now. And I need to watch this with a woman. This feels wrong to be watching this by myself right now. So So we sat down and watched it. And yes, that's when the second viewing I did pick up the, because I thought it was just pure drum, and no, it's absolutely not. There's other stuff there. And it was actually really interesting to see that. Jennifer, I did want to circle back to one other thing you talked about with the learning something about what was happening outside of your lived experience. What was the biggest surprise for you in, or how did your thoughts on this whole process change having seen the film and been exposed to things outside of yourself?
You know, it's interesting. One of the things, and this is interesting because, again, this is came from Donna and I's first conversations, is one of the things I always feel is so guilty whenever I spend too much time away from our daughter. And this was a huge project where every night and every day, you know, we were working on this nonstop. And but in the film, I could see how much she was a part of it and, you know, sort of in the gooey center of the heart of it. And that's always been true on why I wanted to do it and why it was so important to me. But I felt that, oh, great, you're doing this beautiful thing for your daughter and neglecting her while you run off and go do it. But in watching the film, I felt like, oh, I could see how we did hold her very preciously, you know, throughout. And like seeing her and I skip together, like I didn't remember that until I saw the footage. And so that I don't want to, I'm going to cry, but that to me was just like this really lovely gift of like, oh, I can watch this and I can feel and know that like that fear that I have, which is a healthy fear to have, but it wasn't as big as I thought, I could take some solace kind of in seeing the bigger picture of it.
If you, as a parent, if you don't think you're fucking up every day of your life, you're probably not doing it right. So if you think you have it nailed, you're probably not doing a great job parenting. And in my estimation. I mean, yeah, what a wonderful thing, this time capsule that you have to go back and see her at this just wonderful age in this thing. And you can see that. What a wonderful gift that is.
It's stunning to me. It's quite stunning.
Because I'm sure she's already not that little girl anymore. She's probably like this, she's almost a teenager and ready to move out at this point, probably.
Yes. Yes, she's ready to drive and get an apartment. And then too, for her to see the film and see people's reaction to the film. And, you know, it's been such a family experience. And so, yeah, that was quite a gift for me.
The other takeaway for me was there's no way in hell I would spend a winter in Minnesota. That just
That's fair.
I live in Tucson, Arizona. That isn't. I am not cut out for that. Seeing that snow and what y'all deal with, there's no way.
Yeah,
it was a bit shocking at first. Yes,
it's funny because it's. I think that's not my favorite. There's many things that are favorites, but the women arriving from Japan and realizing how very cold it actually was, and the fact that. I don't know if you had this conversation with anyone, Jen, but like, I didn't even think about the fact that it was winter in Minnesota until we were about to shoot the concert. Like I was just like, of course, you know, February works for my schedule, works for other people's schedule, February. Like, didn't cross my mind that that might also be a character that, you know, that is very apparent to folks who don't live in Minnesota. Cause for me, it's February. Yeah,
that's why I was so proud to take everyone to a patio lunch where they had those little igloos set up. I was like, we're going to go outside for lunch.
Yeah,
it's such a treat to go outside in February.
It is.
I mean, it's essentially it's June here in Arizona. We don't go outside. It's if you're going outside, you're getting an air conditioned car and going to an air conditioned movie theater. That's the extent of it. So that's, you know, we enjoy our homes in different times of the year. That's all. Mm-hmm. So I'm in the middle of enjoying it. It's you know, 60 right now. So loving
Lovely.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. Diego says, oh, my face is surprised. It's become ice. I thought that was so great.
Okay. When is the film screening? When can people find this? Where can people find this? Where should we send them to get this?
Now. Go to Amazon now.
There we go. Fantastic. Go to Amazon. This is
right
great.
Now.
Right now. Go.
Yeah.
This is an easy one to recommend to people. Honestly, this is such a wonderful, just a beautiful little story. I really genuinely enjoyed it. There's very few documentaries that I watch these days that I actually feel better about the world that I live in. And we all need a little bit of a palate cleanser after the last 4.5 years. And so when I look around at my country and my world right now, there's a lot of things to focus on that make you feel very negative. Thank you for making me feel a little bit better about the world. So I do appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you all. And thank you for taking the time. It's always intimidating to try to interview three people at once. So trying to get that balance right. So thank you all
for talking about that.
Awesome. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it. Time enough to figure you out. Time enough to write this down. Wish me luck. Give me hope.
wisecrack.